For a good bit of this year, we have been reviewing a core teaching in the Buddhist world, the Satipatthana Sutta, Four Foundations of Mindfulness Discourse. The first foundation is mindfulness of the body. Second one is mindfulness of feelings. Third one is mindfulness of the mind. Fourth one is mindfulness of mental phenomena. And more recently, we have been reviewing the fourth foundation, mindfulness and mental phenomena. We just finished reviewing several talks reviewing the what are called the five hindrances. And tonight, I'm going to be reviewing the five aggregates, what are called the panchakanda. Pancha means five, and khanda basically means aggregation, clumping together. I'm going to dive into that a little bit further in a minute. First, I want to read a quote from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the discourse on the first turning of the wheel for liberation. This is a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's an American. The noble truth of suffering, dukkha, monks, is this: birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Associated with the unpleasant is suffering. Dissociation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to receive what one desires is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to grasping are suffering. Now, this notion of suffering, it seems pretty heavy, right? What we're talking about with suffering, I prefer to translate or think about the word dukkha differently than the word suffering. I use distress and confusion to describe dukkha. Distress is the subjective experience of discomfort in all of its forms. Distress might mean discomfort because you're in pain. Discomfort, distress might be because you're desiring something. But there's this agitation, this impulsive reactive urgency that can be pretty subtle or pretty strong. The confusion basically is a fundamental capacity for misperception that humans have to contend with. We're making it up as we go along. We're all trying to make the best fit in terms of our self-experience in the context of what we're perceiving, right? But that best fit is not necessarily reliable. And that's an important aspect of the confusion, is that life is uncertain. It's uncertain about whether it's, gonna rain on my well-planned picnic, or uncertain as to whether or not I'm gonna keep enjoying that dish of ice cream, right? Or the consequences of that. The confusion also can include that I'm a diabetic, and if I believe that I could eat ice cream without it affecting me, my body adversely, that's, confusion. It's kind of self-delusion. So that kind of confusion is what we're talking about, that uncertainty. And it's not a comprehensive process of selfing and acting in the world. So this system is set up to bring some insight about how this process of craving and clinging, the five aggregates subject to grasping, occurs. Now, why the five aggregates. Well, an aggregate is something that is put together in a particular kind of way for a particular purpose. And the classic example is concrete. In concrete, you have cement, which is a processed kind of lime, I believe, and gravel and sand and water in a particular mixture. When they are separate in their own little containers, they're not really aggregated. All I could say that all the grains of sands are aggregated into that container, or all the powder of the cement is aggregated in that container. But we can also talk about the aggregation of all of them. And after a while, there's a chemical reaction that occurs when you make concrete that changes the structure of the material, makes it very hardy, durable, right? So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the five aggregates of clinging. These different kinds of functions in the human experience and how they operate. Now, why is that useful to have that notion of aggregation? Because we tend to assume that, the self is concrete. We also tend to assume that the self, because it seems solid, is impermeable, like concrete. That's not the case. So what we want to do is, in the context of what seems to be the solidity of an enduring autonomous self, is to disaggregate those different functions, right? To be able to be clearly aware of each of the aggregates in particular as it aggregates, as the process of coming together into a self and then that self dissolving occurs. The five aggregates, you might be wondering. Form, feeling, perception, mind conditioning factors, and consciousness. Now, I mentioned the hindrances, right? And the sense desire and so forth and so on. They all, that's the part that and aversion and sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. Those are things we processed earlier. They're ways that the mind comes together, aggregates, that is very demanding of our loyalty, so to speak. But when we can see it as these different functions that are cooperating as functions, not as a self, that is liberating. So I'm going to talk about how these operate. And I want to use this as kind of a preface. Next week, I'm going to be talking about what are called the six sense doors and the fetters. So this next part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So tonight's talk will kind of lead into that topic. So form is basically the data input function, sensory stimulation, pressure, temperature, light, sound, odor, flavor, somatosensory experience, how the limbs are arrayed, so forth and so on, body awareness. Perception is how the mind starts to discern one part of that flood of stimulation. It kind of hones in on that. As I'm sitting here right now, light is stimulating my eyes, sound is stimulating my ears. I'm aware of pressure points in my body, how my body's moving, sound of my voice, so forth and so on. So those are all occurring. But as I was describing each one of them, part of my mind was sort of shrinking in on, okay, this is seeing, this is hearing, this is body sensation, so forth and so on. So that's what perception is. This cascade of stimulation is coming in all the time, and there are different parts of the brain that are processing these various stimuli all the time. The mind is sorting through that and deciding this is important right now. That's the aggregating, right? This is important right now. You pay attention to this. Feeling is the affective tone of what's going on. Pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. So every perception has a feeling tone because it's part of the aggregation, just like every batch of concrete has gravel and has sand, right? Those are elements of it. Conditioning factors. Conditioning factors could be understood to be what goes on when those different elements are put together, how that coming together operates. The conditioning factors are called sankhara. For the most part, what it amounts to is memory. Whenever we have an experience, starting from our first experiences, even before we're born, there's evidence that in gestation, babies respond to external stimuli. And so, from the moment consciousness starts to operate, which is another one of the aggregates, prior experience starts to shape an assumption about what's going on, an assumption about who I am, assumption about what's going on in the world, and assumption about what I should do about it, right? That's going on in consciousness. So if we can imagine two spheres intersecting, and psychologists called a Venn diagram. Just imagine two circles overlapping so that there's a shape, kind of an eye shaped, like shape like a person's eye, where that overlap is. The bottom is form. At the top, the conditioning factors. The intersection, the eye-shaped part, is feeling and perception. All of that is reflected in consciousness. So this concept, the five aggregates of clinging, is a way to deconstruct what is going on there. And the main meaning-making function is the conditioning factors, the sankhara. They're what decide how those systems interact. And for those of you who are here in the room, the charts on the walls are the chetasikas, are those conditioning factors. You notice the first two on the list are feeling and perception. So those factors are what determine a self. Okay, so the binding part is relates to craving and clinging, which is sort of like the chemical reaction that goes on when those different elements of concrete are put in proximity, right? But for humans, for our experience, this coming together just occurs for a fraction of a second, and it falls apart, comes together, aggregates, disaggregates over and over again. And instead of talking about the chemical reaction of the concrete, what we're talking about is the binding together of these different moments that creates a stream of consciousness. Some of you have heard me use this next simile before. I think it's useful. back in the day when films really meant long strips of celluloid with photographs on them, if you looked at that strip away from a projector, you just obviously a bunch of images. And they all look pretty much the same unless there's an editing cut, and there might be a whole different image the next part of that film. You put that in a device, machine, we call a projector, with the right light, the right focus, the right speed, that those images, each one of those images is flashed on a screen for a fraction of a second, then it goes away and comes back on, goes away, comes back on, goes away. But our mind, our brain, binds them together. These are actually called binding moments of consciousness. And there's even a description of that in terms of what goes on neurologically in the brain that constitutes the binding moments. It's called the loop. In that, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago on a Dharma talk, and I'm bringing this up because this whole notion of the five aggregates, when we can be aware, as I'm sitting in, like I was talking about before the meeting, during the meditation period before, I tend to get in a really irritating itch on the left side of my nose and on the skin right next to it on my upper lip. And for me, it's sort of like a marker. It's like a milestone. Because when I get deeper and deeper into my meditation practice, it's not unusual for that area to start to fire up. And even though it's just a few neurons, a few nerve endings that are stimulated, that are acting, it seems really, really powerful. That's the aggregation of form in terms of whatever's going on in those neurons, feeling, which is the adverse reaction, the resistance, the contraction in the mind and the body relative to that, wanting to push it away, get rid of it. But there's another function that I put into play, which is acceptance. I intentionally decide to accept that felt sense of urgency with openness and curiosity. Now, there's still a reaction in my body. There's still tension. The breathing pattern has changed. There's a felt sense of urgency. So that's form, perception, feeling, and the mind wants to reject it. Alternatively, there are sankharas that are wholesome, that counteract that reactivity, that preoccupation. And so I engage that. I put that into practice. I decide that that's where my practice is right now. It's not a mistake. It's not an obstacle. It's just practice. Now, what's curious about that is the more that I can sit with that reactivity and deliberately let go of the reactivity, soften it, let it drain away, that sensation loses its predominance. The urgency diminishes. What's also interesting is that the mind will suddenly flip to another channel. And that urgent, unpleasant sensation in my nose, it just doesn't seem to be there. There's something else on the screen of my mind, right? Another kind of sankhara operation is predominant. And then, after some period of time, some breaths away, that uncomfortableness comes back again. Right. Now, sometimes I'll scratch it, but I want to be intentional about scratching it to make a decision to eliminate that irritation so I can go back to cultivating stability and tranquility with my attention, with watching the breath. Or I can sit with it. Tonight, I decided to sit with the urgency. So That's a way to understand how to kind of see the aggregates, the elements of the aggregates. I was aware of the sensation. I was aware of the reactivity, which involved a perception and a feeling. I was aware of how the mind was making plans. In other words, to scratch the itch. And like I said, if I had scratched the itch, as long as I'm mindfully aware of it, it's part of the practice. It's part of what the mind does to try to intervene when suffering occurs. I decided tonight that my practice was in a place to be able to just kind of accept it and watch what happens, right? So that's the mind conditioning factors, and all of that's occurring in consciousness. Finally, not finally, the next thing I want to say is that consciousness is like the screen in a movie theater, right? The screen is just reflective. That's its whole function. Doesn't have an identity. It doesn't have a purpose other than reflecting light that's radiated onto it. So it's kind of blank until something's projected on it, right? That's how consciousness operates as part of the five aggregates. It's just the quality of aware receptivity. That's what it is. Now, when we can pay attention to that, there's value in it. One of the values, as I already described, is the ability to work with what is rather than trying to fight it. Another value is to have a clearer awareness or understanding of the transitory and dreamlike characteristic of what goes on in the mind. And we're dreaming all the time. We're making it up as we go along. So being aware that the mind, one of the things that happens when I can really be mindful of this feeling, this perception, this is, et cetera, et cetera. This is aversion. Alternatively, this is acceptance. This is equanimity. As those awarenesses develop, it starts to deconstruct the notion that there's somebody running the show, that there is ultimately a very reliability to control what goes on. That's what I meant about the uncertainty that's associated with the confusion, distress and confusion, is that I can have an expectation of myself in the world, but it's just a condition. It's not inherently realistic. The mind makes it so. So, how do we deal with this? Here's a translation of that passage in the Fourth Foundation of Mindfulness, translated by Tanissero. Furthermore, monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates. And how does he remain focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates? There is the case where a monk discerns such as form, such as origination, such as disappearance, such as feeling, such as perception, such are fabrications, such as consciousness, such its origination, such its disappearance. In this way, he remains focused internally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or externally on mental qualities in and of themselves, or both internally and externally on mental qualities in and of themselves. Or he remains focused on the phenomena of origination with regard to mental qualities, on the phenomenon of passing away with regard to mental qualities, or on the phenomenon of origination and passing away with regard to mental qualities. Or is mindfulness that there are mental qualities is maintained to the extent of knowledge and remembrance, and he remains independent unsustained by, not clinging to, anything in the world. This is how a monk remains focused on mental qualities in and of themselves with reference to the five clinging aggregates. So, one of the things that's really interesting for me about this five aggregates concept is that when I was in graduate school to become a mental health professional, obligatory course on, you know, was necessary on what are called personality theories. Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, Carl Rogers, those people. One of those chapters was written by a fellow named Daniel Goleman. And he presented the five aggregates as a theory of personality in that chapter. I was thrilled. My classmates couldn't care less. Wasn't going to be on the test. They couldn't care less. The professor couldn't care less. I was really excited because part of what I think has been helpful for me psychologically, in terms of my own personality, as well as a psychotherapy, being a psychotherapist, was this ability to understand this is how we make a self, and it's malleable. We can change our minds. We can train ourselves to be more self-aware and a kind of deeper introspective awareness and more self-disciplined in terms of our how we respond to feelings, perceptions, and feelings. There are more notes there, and they will be posted with this. But what I want to do at this point is to open up an opportunity for you all to ask questions or make observations about your experience. Now, here's the context. What was your experience during the meditation? I talked about what was going on for me, but you know, I'm trained to be able to notice the impersonal nature of the five aggregates, in particular, the different aggregates themselves, right? To be able to identify, okay, that's what's going on there, what's going on there, what's going on there. To be able to notice that, that's what insight is all about, to see them as a way that the human brain makes sense out of experience. Or you could just simply ask for clarification about the conceptual structure itself. So, questions or comments about Panchakanda, the five aggregates of clinging? Yes, Leslie.
Peter, I notice every time you talk about self, the formation of a self, you use the word endurable. And there's another adjective you use, an endurable...
What is autonomous.
That? Autonomous. There's no endurable autonomous self. Does that suggest that in these small moments of coming together, there is a self?
No, does not mean that. That was something that people would ask the Buddha back in the day. Is there a self that comes together at that moment and then it goes away? No,
no.
It's just a phenomenon. It's the same kind of phenomena as a wave in the ocean. Different factors, some of them from 1,000 miles away, will contribute to the shape of a particular wave as it approaches the shore. And the temperature of the water, temperature of the air, the way the winds are blowing, what was happening 1,000 miles away, all of those give a shape to what we call a wave. And it does its thing and survive, and then subsides. So it's convenient to call that a wave, but where does that wave leave off and the rest of the ocean begin, right?
Yeah.
So It's not autonomous. It's part of the ocean. It's not durable because it doesn't last.
But okay, that's helpful. Okay, let's go to this the film metaphor then. So you do, when you watch a movie, you do have an experience of narrative, of events happening, pictures happening. So I guess I'm just trying to see how I cannot dismiss totally the notion of there is some kind of experience that momentarily is seems real.
Yep, that's the big quandary, isn't it? One of the things that's important to understand is that there are different levels of understanding and application. One of them is psychological. It's a really good way to manage stress. Even this whole notion of the five aggregates. I mean, it was very helpful for me as a psychotherapist in terms of my own process in relationship and perhaps helping this other person or persons in their experience. So there's that utility. And if that's all I can get out of it is to be a more well-integrated personality, that's very good. I'm very glad. And it's built on those principles, the same principles, Buddhist doctrine. And then there's the liberating aspect of it, which is the experience of non-self, right? Which is sort of implicit in the psychological value. If there was a self, we couldn't change it. So the Buddha, people would really push the Buddha on this. Is there a self in a moment? No, there's not. Is there a self that comes to life and goes away? No, that's not true either. What he kept saying was, it's process. It's all about process. So all you got to pay attention to.
Yeah.
The question of whether there's a self or not is misleading. It does not lead to liberation. So, on the one hand, to function in the world, we do have to operate as if there's a self. On the other hand, the more there's a direct realization of the impersonality of that and the transitory nature of it. I was describing, my mind would be all wrapped around, got to scratch that itch, got to scratch that itch. And then in the next moment, it was gone. It wasn't there anymore. Now, that nerve ending, I don't know if the nerve ending stopped firing off or just my mind switched channels, but it certainly wasn't durable. And that whole tension and reactivity was not there. To notice that is liberating. That's noticing impermanence.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. David, how can I help you, sir?
Yes, I wanted to make certain. I think my mind wandered when you were discussing consciousness. Can you go again over the definition of consciousness in the yes, consciousness.
Well, I'll go back to my notes and read you what I have in there about vijnanakanda.
Yanakanda.
Vijnana, V-I-N-N-A-N-A, vijnana, consciousness. It's one of the ways that Buddhism describes consciousness. There's vijnana, there's manas, there's citta, different ways. But this is what I got from a book called Identity and Experience, written by Sue Hamilton. Well, first I'll read what I put down there. Vijnana is typically translated as consciousness. Like sankhara, it's a complex term depending on the context of its use. Two terms are almost synonymous with vijnana, citta and manas. So here's what was in Wikipedia, and they quoted from Sue Hamilton. There's a similarity between vijnana and citta. They're both associated with the qualitative condition of a human being. Vijnana provides awareness and continuity by which one knows one's moral condition. Citta is an abstraction representing that condition. Citta is therefore closely related to volitions. This connection is also etymologically, as citta comes from the same verbal root in Pali as the active terms meaning to will. Okay, so let me put that in context more of what I was talking about a minute ago. That when we talk about vijnana, vijnana is the screen. When we talk about what we see on the screen, that's citta. That's the different formations that are being projected into consciousness. So consciousness is just simply receptive awareness. And consciousness has no ethical weight. It's just receptiveness. What puts ethical weight on the screen is the sankhara. What I mean by ethical weight, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, morally or ethically. So does that help?
Yeah, that actually helps a lot. It's
Yeah.
I didn't know that Titta had that many nuances to it. So yeah,
Well,
that was
I
very
have
helpful.
one more. I mentioned manas.
Manas.
Manas is the spectator in the audience watching the screen.
Okay, manas.
MANAS.
That's the observer in the audience.
Right. So the screen is vijnana. What's projected on the screen is citta, and the person or the person the experience of it is manas.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Oh, I can't tell if it's, boredom or stunned silence or
Done.
contemplation.
Hi, Peter, it's Karen.
Hi,
I'll
Karen.
break the silence. My question is, when we are practicing our formal meditation, and trying to, incorporate all of this information, how did you do that? I mean, I know you've been practicing for 40 something years, but I mean, did you spend like a couple years on investigating the aggregates to where you could be so skillful at recognizing all of this? Because I mean, it can't be, to me, I don't know that it could be done in one sitting. I mean,
Sure can. It can be
I'm
done in
just.
one sitting. It can be done very quickly. You have to know how to do it. That's all. And what to look for. So you asked me about, how I got there. I have several books on the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And obviously by different authors with different ways of explaining what goes on in the four foundations. In this case, different explanations about the five aggregates, right? So I have all of that informational background, and I have my meditation practice. Now, I mentioned early on in the discussion, it might have been before you joined us, that when I sit, I want to have some ongoing reference to my breath sensations and my body sensations. That provides a stabilizing point of reference because body experience, including the breath, is nowhere near as fleeting as mental phenomena, right? I mean, I can be aware of the sensation of breathing, but thoughts just kind of flicker through.
Right.
One of the similes that's used is like lightning, like a flash of lightning, right? So The ability to stabilize my attention with breath body awareness allows me to be more discerning, combined with my accumulated knowledge from all my reading, and my meditation practice, my retreat experience, and so forth, allows me to be able to be clear. Okay, this is light, this is visual process, this is auditory process, and be aware that when I'm noticing light, the amplification, the attention to the auditory process is diminished or gone. I alluded to that when I was talking about having an itch, that the sensation, the discomfort, the urgency seems to be predominant. And then the mind will flip to another channel. And all of a sudden, that urgency has just kind of dropped. It's still there, but it will dissipate. And then the itch comes back and the mind jumps right back into the struggle. So I've trained myself to be aware of that. And I'm saying this and remembering something that Ajahn Chah said that I've said so many times, because it's actually a book about him named It's the Still Forest Pool. There's one image in there that he describes that I found very useful. Says that mindfulness of breathing is like sitting by a still forest pool. As you sit there quietly, all kinds of strange and wonderful creatures will come to drink there. So what's the still forest pool is vijnana and citta. It's what's going on the screen. That becomes quieter and quieter and quieter and quieter, as long as I stay with the breath and the body. But then something happens. And the way it's described in the story is that when the mind is there and you're there long enough and you're quiet enough, all kinds of strange and wonderful creatures will come to drink there. That's the part that notices the transitory and impersonal nature of phenomena. The ripples on the surface of the pond are the ripples of thoughts
I
and
see.
reactions. Is that helpful, Karen?
Yes, it is. It is. It takes time. I mean, that's a, it seems like a, takes time.
Work of a lifetime.
Yeah.
I've been practicing for half my life. I'm not done yet. But what I find about it is very interesting for me. What's going to happen this time? What's going to happen this time? It's sort of like a new episode in my favorite TV show, right? What's going to happen this week or this sitting, you know? So it makes it more fun, even when it's uncomfortable, because I have that commitment to working with what life brings me rather than trying to get all rigid and demanding that it has to be a certain way. It's very comfortable to be with the breath and the body for a long time, but the brain is still chugging along, isn't it?
Yes.
The volume on that channel is lowered. The demand for attention and action is diminished. And that's, I think, a major part of my practice. Other questions or
Thank you.
observations? Yes, you're welcome. I mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, if you all had any reflections on what you noticed during your meditation practice prior to the Dharma talk, but also what you may have noticed as I was talking about your own subjective experience. Did any of you have a flash on, oh, I'm hearing, or oh, look how tense the body is right now? Did you all have any of that experience? That's how you make that discernment, is just deciding to check in.
That's good, Peter. I do on a regular basis have that, and I think a lot of it for me is getting older. I mean, things hurt. My knee hurts, or
Yep.
I cough. I can tell as I pay attention to my breath, because I have a fairly messed up lung situation. I'm very aware of tightness and constriction in my lungs.
Is that tightness? Does that tightness and constriction have to be in your mind? See if you can notice when you the mind can be at peace, even though the pneumatic part, the stuff going on around the lungs is different.
Yeah.
See if you can investigate that difference, in the context of one of the important principles of Buddhist psychology called Nama-rupa. Rupa is form. It's part of the five aggregates.
Right.
Nama is feeling, perception, and sankhara and consciousness, right? So you notice the feeling tone. When I say feeling tone, there's a sensation going on around your lungs. And then your mind decides it's tightness or it's pain or it's whatever. That's the mind's process right there, to be able to be aware of that and learn how to be in that zone of what goes on in the body and allowing the mind to be not so tightly wrapped around it.
Oh, that's so helpful for me because in the last few weeks, I'm on the. I want to go back to Jessup this summer for a 10-day retreat, and I've been anxious about it because I get periodically ill, and I don't want to get up there and be ill. But in the last few weeks, I've really been trying to take the. Especially when I'm having a bout with my lungs, to just take that as part of the practice too.
Yep,
Because
absolutely.
I kept thinking I had to find a 10-day period where I wasn't going to have any issues. And I thought,
And
well,
that's
that's
your
not that.
distress and confusion right there.
Yeah, right. I finally said, you know what, girl, you're not going to have that for the rest of your life. You're not going to have that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I want to circle back to this term dukkha again,
Yeah.
distress and confusion. Some of you have heard me say this, what I'm saying now, repeatedly, but I think it's an important part of this training. There are several different etymological considerations about that word. The one that I appreciate has to do with the Aryans. The Aryans were a particular group of tribes that moved into northern India during the Vedic age, during the early consolidation of India into a civilization. And they were travelers. They had carts and wheeled carts. So dukkha meant the poor fit between the axle of the cart and the hub of the wheel. And if it was a poor fit, it would be a bumpy ride and the wheel would fall off at unpredictable, probably inconvenient times. That's dukkha, a rough ride that's unpredictable. So I really think that that's a useful way to understand dukkha. The word suffering is so loaded.
Yeah.
But, I can work on distress, learning how to let go, calm the heart mind, the breath body. That's useful. And as I can do that, that alleviate that creates a better fit, so to speak. But the assumption that the wheel's never going to fall off the axle, that's the confusion part. Of course it's going to happen. Of course the pain is going to come back. Of course I'm not going to be able to predict when it happens or whether I can do anything about it or not,
Right.
right? But this whole notion of the five aggregates, as I said at the beginning, is an attempt to deconstruct the conditioned experience of selfing, to see these different functions that are interactive, cooperating. And seeing that is liberating. We
Yes.
don't take ourselves so seriously. Or when I do take myself too seriously, I'm aware of it. Says, wow, you really grabbed that one, didn't you?
Peter,
Sharon.
Hey, this is really, really pithy conversation. I'm practicing in my everyday experiences. I bike, try to bike to go places, get on a bike, pedal, and be connected to the experience and observations within and around me. And I experienced today something that kind of keys into what Leslie was saying and you're talking about. I was breathing my breath. I was paying attention to my breath, and it wasn't it was making a noise. I mean, I as I was in, you know, it was a lung. My lungs were expanding. My lungs were contracting because I was pedaling. You know, it's not like a meditation breathing. It's active, and
Well,
I
that
was
can be
paying attention.
meditation breathing too.
Well, it was, but it was active. Oh, well, oh, okay. You say, oh, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, it could, but when I'm exerting myself, it's a different type of breath. I
Yes.
guess that's what I want to say. And the exertion, and it wasn't really serious exertion. I wasn't, but it was enough to make that noise in my lungs, in the depth of my lungs. And it reminded me of, I'll just say, what I was curious about it. And what is that? You know? And then I focused on it as I was breathing, and I could change a little bit in my either the depth of the breath or the length of the breath, but it was all from the lungs. You know, it wasn't a shallow breathing. And the thing that was interesting about it was that I could almost, I mean, I could minimize it so that it disappeared.
Yes.
And I could also allow it to return. And it was just interesting. That's kind of what I want to say about that. I could have had a worry around it, which I did not. And that's the thing. We end up, I think we have a society that's over focused on things like that, and we're anticipating, oh my gosh, what is that noise? Uh oh, something's wrong. And rather than having that kind of a response, just allowing it. And the other thing I want to say, there's a certain arrogance I think that goes with our views of how our bodies are declining. I mean, I could allow myself to come up with, oh yeah, well, this is going to happen because I'm old, or this is, and I'm not saying that anybody else is thinking that, but it, I know other people who have that idea of, oh yeah, well, this is because of that. And what I think is that that's arrogance, because it may or may not be that.
Yeah,
And I
the,
think
actually, the term that the sankhara in that regard, Sharon, is conceit, and
okay,
it's a
that's a good
particular
one, yeah.
context in Buddhist psychology. You just described it as arrogance, but it's the assumption that there's a self, and that the world should be the way the self wants it to be. And it's not.
You mean it's not allowing for it to be different,
Right.
that worldview or whatever you want to call it.
That's the arrogance or the conceit.
And I am comfortable knowing that things will come and things will go. I'll feel things, I'll experience things. I may feel weaker, I may feel stronger. It may be one day this way, and maybe I didn't get enough sleep, and you know, there are all these other things, you know, that are metabolic going on.
Yep. So we're actually at the end of our time tonight. I appreciate all of the comments that you all have made. I certainly enjoy responding to these questions, and I hope that your own experience going forward is benefited by what we've been talking about tonight. I mentioned at the beginning of the talk that Next week, the focus of the talk, and I'll be giving the Dharma talk, will be on what are called the six sense spheres and the fetters. And just a kind of a preview about that, I describe the six sense spheres in terms of the five aggregates: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, embodied experience. Those are the five sense doors. The sixth sense door is the mind, right? And in the mind in this context could be the screen or what's projected on the screen or the observer of what's projected on the screen. So the fetters represent that which keeps the mind tricked into believing that there is a screen, that there's a projector and a projection, and somebody in the audience watching the show. So that's what the fetters do. They liberate the mind from that assumption. Even though we live in a world that requires that we have an ego that must be defended or gratified. All right, so it's our custom at the end of our meetings to sit together in silence for a brief interval. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.